Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is co-host Dr. Matt Polacek.
For those of you who have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much.
And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain.
While bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful.
Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
We will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the area of health, security, and fun for you and your family.
Now, with our experience of working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
And so, as today we bring Ted on, who we'll introduce in a little bit, it reminds me really of, in my background as the director at the Betty Ford Center, our society's general true failure in the field of drug addiction and drug treatment. The numbers coming out now that as far as accidental deaths in the United States, drug addiction actually outnumbers anything else, including car accidents. And I was looking at really the evolution of treatment and how and the idea that we send people to quote rehabs and they go for quote like 30 days and they're cured and this idea basically driven by managed care and by finances that people go away to treatment and they get quote fixed and then they come back. And what we're really learning through science and through just the evolution in the field is that really addiction is a chronic disease, and it's not something that is just, quote, cured in a 30-day span. And what we're trying to do at the Betty Ford Center, and I think a lot of the leaders in the field of addiction are really trying to make sure that people understand this disease model, and we'll discuss today a little bit more what that means, and to really destigmatize this idea and this notion of addiction. The field, I feel, also has basically failed us in a lot of ways, where the educators and the leaders haven't had enough education. So, for instance, when I got my doctorate up in Berkeley, there was one class, I think, on addiction. A lot of my friends in the medical community who are doctors have one shift or one rounds dealing with addiction. The marriage and family therapists out there take one class to one semester on addiction. And the true education of the field really is limited in what its professionals are given. So I started out about 20 years ago in private practice, ambitious and excited to help treat people in our field. And what I noticed was a lot of just failure, a lot of relapse, a lot of struggles in working one-on-one with patients. And so that led me to kind of really explore the treatment field and really what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. And there's maybe two or three main things that I took away from that. The one thing is the addiction is in recovery is probably the only or one of the only kind of diagnoses that I feel does better treatment-wise in groups and in mm-hmm. community. And this goes from the AA community to groups in a treatment center, but there's something healing about meeting others with similar afflictions that they've had in their life that you share, and there's something in that kind of healing process. That was one of the biggest takeaways I took from it. And the other thing that I noticed really was that even in 2016, we really kind of have a shame-based approach to it, you know, so that people in recovery or people that are living a recovery lifestyle are, quote, addicts. And are labeled, and I'm really looking forward to when Ted comes on today discussing, you know, what that is and what that's kind of done to society and done to people in the recovery community. But I guess without further ado, our guest today, Ted Collins, he's had a career as a successful entrepreneur, executive, and investor in the global mobile telecom industry for almost 20 years. Before substance use disorder, made his life really unmanageable.
And since the beginning of his journey in recovery in 2014, Ted co-founded Mober Inc. That's M-O-B-E-R, which is a technology company that develops apps, their mobile apps, for the recovery community, with the mission of making it easier for people pursuing recovery in connection with each other and local recovery resources.
Ted also launched Young People's in Recovery's Los Angeles chapter and has served as California state captain for the Unite to Face Addiction Rally. Most recently, Ted was named to the National Board of Young People in Recovery.
A native of San Francisco, California, Ted has lived in Los Angeles for the past 3 years. Ted holds a BA in government cum laude from Harvard College and an MBA from INSED in France. In addition to recovery-related activities, Ted is an avid cyclist, and he recently completed his first AIDS lifestyle ride from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and is a classically trained lyric baritone and a linguist. He speaks 5 languages. So, Ted, in English, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be here with you.
Well, it's really good to have you. And Jan, who books our shows, I know that she's the one that you spoke with. A few months ago, I contacted her after seeing a video of what it is that you were doing, and I believe the video involved community. And as I started to look more into it, I got in touch with her, and I said, Jan, this is exactly what this show is all about. This show is about getting information out to people who need resources. And to me, this app is the type of resource that so many people out there need. So we're so glad not only that you're here with us, but that you took the time to set up an app like this for so many people out there in need.
Well, thank you so much. And I am very grateful that we're able to bring our story to your platform and to communicate the importance of recovery to the community.
You know, the research of William White, which I don't know if you two are familiar with, basically, it looks into this idea of recovery management. And recovery management is basically everything put together that keeps people in recovery and live a, you know, healthy, happy kind of life. And a big aspect of that is community. And he kind of says it is a recovery capital, which is the amount of, you know, resources that one person has. And a big part of that is community. Ted, for you, was kind of hitting this area, community, the main kind of grounds that you use to develop this app?
Well, the first thing that I came to understand when I first sought recovery was that I was isolated in the depths of my disease. I was isolated from community, from the people that I loved, and also from other people who could have shown me that there was an opportunity to get well. And so, you know, for me, developing a community is the antidote to you know, being in active addiction, because you're connecting to other people. And that is so important, not only to know that you're not alone, but also to know that there are role models out there that can show you how to get well and stay well.
Yeah, and I see it as that form of aftercare, and having started in this industry over 30 years ago, it was the biggest component that I saw that was missing, which was that level of aftercare. Because here, as a person who transports people to these programs, and they're going there for a determined amount of time, that they would come out of that and they would go back to possibly an environment that may have been part of the cause in the beginning. So the concept of aftercare, and again, the industry has done a great job of now adding therapy afterwards and such, but that piece that wasn't there, I think, is exactly what it is that you bring to the table, which is, here's a community of people that you're now going to choose You know, you get to choose now who the community is. In the very beginning, I think that there's someone assigned to you, but they're assigned to you. You're not making that choice. So this is something that again, I think is such a great addition. Tell us a little bit in regards to, you know, as you were putting this together, what were the components that you looked at and thought, okay, these are the key issues that I think are going to help the most people?
Well, the most important thing or the most interesting thing that I saw right off the bat is that there are a lot of us, not only people that suffer from substance use disorder, but people who are in long-term recovery. In 2014, I think it was the National Institutes of Health put out some figures which included 22 million people in long-term recovery in the United States out of a total of 45 million that suffer from substance use disorder. So that's a lot of people. And, you know, part of the issue that we're trying to help to unravel is the fact that there is so much stigma that makes it, you know, very difficult for a lot of people to feel comfortable proclaiming their recovery, mm-hmm. to wear it proudly, as I think that they should. Because, you know, people who have recovered from this seemingly hopeless state of body and mind are warriors. They're champions. They are people that have beaten the odds. And they should be proud of that. And I also think it's, you know, part of my responsibility as somebody who has recovered to show other people that it's possible and, you know, give them some ideas of how they might be able to do it too. You know, the way that I've recovered doesn't necessarily have to be the way that they do, but there are so many different ways, so many different pathways to recovery. And to know about those, to have knowledge is power. Because when I first, you know, when I was in the depths of my disease, I didn't know that I'd be able to get better. I thought that I had screwed up my life entirely. And, you know, I thought what I kept on thinking was that I had to figure out a way to get back to where I had been before, to the same success, to the same lifestyle that I had before. But that is a totally wrong way of looking at it, because if I tried to stay with that same lifestyle, I'd probably get the same results. So I had to be willing to have an open mind and consider that I don't know exactly what the future is going to look like, but I can't keep doing what I'm doing now. And without having a role model to help me to figure out that that's possible, I just kept on spinning out because I just thought that I was done.
And for those listeners out there, the venue for this and the avenue really is this app called Mober. Tell us a little bit about Mober.
So Mober is a mobile social network that we've created for people in long-term recovery or people who are pursuing long-term recovery to connect with one another. It is based on, it takes your GPS reading of where you are, and it basically pops your profile up next to other people in your community who are also pursuing recovery so that you can connect with them for recovery support, for fellowship, for getting information about, you know, how other people in your community have done the things that you're trying to do. And also, it's a way for us to put out information about the local recovery events that we are putting together so that people can not only meet on the app, but they can get together in person and really revel in this recovery lifestyle.
You know, at Betty Ford, one of the great kind of, to me, one of the best qualities of working for a company that's so so broad across the country and through the Hazleton Network is having such a strong alumni. And having that alumni presence, I feel, really separates us as far as other treatment programs, because as far as when people are discharging and going through outpatient and going back into the, quote, real world, having people to connect to in the recovery community is essential, as you know. The one area I thought is weakest really is this ability to find people, to find events, and to be able to communicate with people that you could relate to, like Alan was saying, in the recovery community. Mober basically, to me, seems like this missing link.
Well, I'm glad that you think so. That's exactly the idea. We are a very new company, and we have bootstrapped our way to having this first, what we call the minimum viable product version of the app. But we do have ambitions of becoming the connector for people all throughout the country, in, you know, connecting to their local recovery community. So my idea is that, for example, if people are releasing from Betty Ford, for example, that when they're at Betty Ford, they will create a mobile profile, and they will be able to connect with all of their cohort at Betty Ford locally, save those people as their buddies so that they can see them wherever they are. But then they'll go back to their, let's say they go back to New York, they open it up there, and they will see a whole bunch of new people that could be great allies or fellows in their long-term recovery. And, you know, that is the first thing that this app is able to accomplish. The next thing that we're hoping to do as part of our long-term product roadmap is to connect people with resources as well. I personally know that there are, for example, here in Los Angeles, tens of thousands of thousands of weekly 12-step meetings. And, you know, to be able to open up an app and see which apps, which meetings are available around me, not only in terms of distance, but also in terms of time and date.
Which ones are open meetings, which one? Right.
Exactly. All of that information would make it a lot easier for me to remain connected to recovery. You know, this isn't only 12-step meetings, but it's also, you know, smart recovery meetings, refuge recovery, Life Ring, all of those things are what we want to put into that second version of the app and allow people not only to connect with the people or, you know, the, their cohort in recovery, but also to the resources that will allow them to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ted, many of the people that I'm working with are underage because we're transporting them to specialized programs in other states. Those same kids, when they're done, are going back to wherever it was that they came from. So the first part of what you were talking about makes perfect sense. But is there right now, is there an age restriction right now on the app?
Well, I'm glad that you asked that because it's actually something that I was talking about this past weekend at the YPR convention. It is important for us to say that, you know, we're the app is open to people, you know, 18 and up is what we're saying, because we want to make sure that there is no predatory behavior that's going on, things like that. Obviously, anybody can download it, but, you know, we want to kind of cater more towards the people that are 18 and up.
That makes sense. And along those lines, how does Mober handle anonymity?
So anonymity is a big tradition in the 12-step community, and it's also understandable that people don't necessarily want to reveal their identity to people who are not also in recovery. So we have built in a public versus a private profile. And so in the public profile, you can create a, you know, divulge as much information as you feel comfortable. And, you know, in the profile creation section, you can determine which information is available on your public versus your private profile. And, you know, if you don't want to reveal your identity in a photograph, you put up a photograph of a sunset or of your dog or whatever it is. And then once you have taken the action of opening your profile and establishing a buddy relationship with someone else, then you can reveal your full identity. And even at that point, you don't have to. It's really up to you to say what depth of information you're comfortable revealing. But, you know, it makes it a lot easier, I think, to understand that you have something in common with someone, you know, even something deeper with them. If you know that, oh, we went to the same recovery center, you know, I have the same drug of choice as that person, or, you know, I'm also interested in stand-up paddle boarding, you know, those types of things that'll make it easy to search out people that you have even more in common with.
Yeah, when we were Al and I were on the app earlier today, and I thought it was really useful. It also, you know, talks about how many days people are in recovery, things that similar interests people would have, and the other area that I'm really excited about with Mober is, you know, earlier we talked about the stigma, and I think that living in LA, like you said, there's so many AA meetings, there's a lot of smart recovery meetings, there's, for those out there that, you know, are against AA or struggle with it. There's other alternatives like Smart Recovery that Ted mentioned and other groups. But the one thing I think to destigmatize it really is to have the numbers. And for people, when we were on the app, you know, there was people that were in Salt Lake City and other areas. For me in LA, we have a very strong recovery community. But one of my concerns is in the smaller communities, and this is an opportunity really for people to find people in those communities where they didn't, you know, think there was that many people in the recovery cohort.
Well, our ambition is to connect, is for everybody who is pursuing recovery to look to MOBRA as the platform to connect with one another. Again, if they are worried about their anonymity, they still can create a profile and then just reach out to people either locally or, you know, far away if they want, to get the support that they need via the app. But ultimately, what we would like for them to do is to be able to connect to people in person so that they can reinforce each other's recovery lifestyles. So, you know, people who are listening right now, please do go create a profile on the app and invite your cluster of people in recovery to do the same. And then, you know, little by little, you'll be able to add people just like that old Prel commercial or whatever it was. You tell your friends, they tell their friends, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and again, for those of you listening, and again, we appreciate that, you can go to moberapp.com. That's moberapp.com. If you're sitting at your desk right now, you can open up another window and you can follow along with us. Now, obviously, if you're driving, don't try this.
I'd also recommend, just so that you can get a feel for the type of community and the type of brand that we're developing, to go to our Facebook page.
Okay.
It's it's facebook.com/MOBRAapp. And there you'll see a whole bunch of videos and infographics that help to promote what it is that we're trying to create here. You'll see specifically the things that we're most proud of here in the LA community are some group service events where we've gotten people together from the community to be of service to other members of the community. For example, we've gone and we've rehabilitated two different local recovery centers, and we've also gone and done as a group supporting something called #lunchbag, which is a fantastic thing where you know, in a party environment on a Sunday morning, you pack bag lunches for people. Then you go down to Skid Row and you deliver those, you distribute those. And it's a really great way to be of service. And I'm not the only one that thinks this, but service is an essential part of recovery. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it helps to get you out of yourself. Mm-hmm. And it also helps to build your self-esteem because you're helping other people. And it also just feels good.
That's one of the things that amazes me and blows me away about the recovery community is the be of service aspect of it. The other side of that, though, is activities, events. And when I'm looking, when I'm working with a lot of our outpatient patients, for me, a lot of the empirical research shows, and like through Seeking Safety and other treatment, you know, programs, that building structure and building plans into their weekends and into their weeks and early recovery is critical. And it's my understanding MOBRA does offer some activities outside of be of service.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you brought that up because we're also very, very excited about a series of sporting tournaments that we've started to put together. We just actually 2 weeks ago hosted our second what we're calling the MOBRA Invitational Beach Volleyball Tournament. And at this one, which was down in Huntington Beach, we had 27 teams from local recovery residences that participated in a day-long recovery volleyball event. And there's a video of this also on our Facebook page. And people had such a great time. There are people who are in very early recovery, you know, say the first 6 months, let alone maybe even the first 30 days, who came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I didn't realize that I could have this much fun and not be, you know, high or drunk.
Sure.
In fact, I haven't been up this early on a Sunday morning in gosh knows how long, and it was great. People are already asking us to bring that event to their community. And it's also was really a great thing for me as you know, a representative of young people in recovery, is that we were able to do it as a fundraiser. The one that we did in LA, in Santa Monica rather, was a fundraiser for the West LA chapter of young people in recovery. And the one that we did down in Huntington Beach was a fundraiser for the Orange County chapter. And, you know, those funds will then allow those chapters to spread their message as well.
And speaking of young people's in recovery, now I believe you were just at a conference. I think it was in Denver. I believe it's their annual conference. Share with us a little bit about what they're looking at on a more national level.
Absolutely. So Young People in Recovery is a nationwide recovery advocacy group, nonprofit that was started about 5 years ago as an initiative of SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, trying to empower young people to get involved in bringing about change in the United States and how we deal with addiction and recovery. So it has grown to, I think it's 74 chapters around the country. And this national leadership conference had representatives from each of those 74 chapters that came together for 3 days so that we could educate and inform them and also celebrate the victories that we as an organization and also as chapters were able to achieve during the past calendar year.
All right. Well, that's great. You know what? We're going to take a break. For everybody, please stay with us. We're talking with Ted Collins. The app is called Mober, and we will be right back in 1 minute.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. I am your co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, with Alan Cardoza, and our guest today is Ted Collins. Ted, when I was thinking about during the break, in regards to some of the patients I work with in early recovery, a lot of what comes up for me is accountability and kind of making sure that they're attending meetings and that they're kind of calling sponsors and people in their community. Is that something that's come up for Mober at all?
Absolutely. In our product roadmap, and something that we're actually in the process of building right now, is a dashboard which will allow sober livings and treatment centers to track adherence of their clients to what their aftercare prescriptions include. So, for example, when I was in sober living, which was a very important part of my journey in recovery, I needed to fill out a daily personal business form. And that included, you know, where I was going to be, which meetings I was going to be attending, you know, if I was going to see my therapist or going to an intensive outpatient program. And, you know, it was important for me to know, to have that structure. But, you know, I also saw some people that took advantage of that. You know, the meeting slips that people typically have signed at meetings can be forged. You know, people aren't necessarily being monitored as closely as they should in these step-down programs. So, you know, technology will facilitate doing a better job with that. So with the app, the next version of the app is going to give people the ability to check in at meetings, for example, or check in at the different places around town where they are supposed to be. And it also will be able to show, you know, on a tracking basis, if people have deviated from their plan or gone into a neighborhood where they shouldn't, et cetera. And of course, this will be an opt-in type of thing. So each client will opt into being tracked by their mm-hmm. their you know, recovery institution. But I really think that it's an important way to make to create more accountability so people make better decisions.
Yeah, and you had said earlier that if you went back to doing things the same way, it wouldn't have worked. And what was coming up for me as you were talking is a lot of my friends in the recovery community basically have a way of living, you know, of be of service, of holding some kind of personal values. And basically, to me, it's a lifestyle, and it's really a way of life. How do you kind of see the recovery, like, messaging portion of it?
Well, I'm glad that you asked that question, because I absolutely think that recovery is a lifestyle choice, much as, you know, a person with type 2 diabetes has to make the choice to eat more healthy diet. And, you know, there's also a focus generally, especially here in Southern California, on living a lifestyle of health and sustainability. So, you know, what we hope to be able to do, not only as MOBR, but also through YPR and in general, is to make role models more apparent for people who are living and thriving in lifestyles, in their recovery lifestyle. You know, for me, it's as simple as knowing that I'm going to enjoy my day better because I'm going to go to sleep early and sober and be able to wake up early and take advantage of the day in front of me. It's just, that's a choice, because I feel better that way, you know. And I now, since I have some distance from my active use, I know what it feels like to feel good, you know, and I know what it feels like not to wake up in fear or in shame or anything like that. So I want to hold on to that. So part of the messaging portion of that is to make it clear to people, not only who are still suffering, but also people who may hold some stigmatized beliefs mm-hmm. about recovery, that recovery is possible, that it's aspirational. And, you know, some of the things that I would focus on, for example, is language. Language such as, you know, people talk about addiction. And addiction, you know, has some negative connotations to it. If you think about an addict, you think about a junkie or you know, a wino or a loser or a criminal or something like that. And that doesn't help anybody to have that type of language. So, you know, addiction is a disease. And if we can choose language that reflects the fact that these are sick people, not bad people, it's important to do that. So instead of addiction, what we like to say is substance use disorder. It's not substance abuse. It's not substance misuse. It's substance use disorder, because that means that somebody has a problem, a medical problem, that, you know, hopefully they'll be able to address. And knowing that they are not bad people will help not only them to seek help, but also help other people to have some compassion and some empathy for them, which is something that I think is sorely missing in a lot of cases for people who have gone pretty far down, you know, down the hole in their substance use.
You know, as you're speaking and you mentioned diabetes, I think that, and I'm going to get on my soapbox a little bit here, if you guys don't mind, about the true chronic disease notion, or the true chronic disease of substance use disorder. And when you look at diabetes, it's the actual perfect comparison. They're very similar in so many different ways, from onset to the fact that ends in death if it's not managed. And there's also the personal accountability portion of it, to where if you have diabetes, you have to be personally accountable to check your insulin levels, blood sugar, diet, yada, yada, yada. It's the same thing people with substance use disorder, where they have to check in on where they're at. And that level of check-in really is different from person to person, I feel. And so that, where an app like this comes in, really is an opportunity for people to basically put themselves into a community at the level where they're comfortable. And the greatest part is, again, being an app, you can do it from your home, you can do it from anywhere you're at. And so I think that first step is easier with, you know, applications like this.
Absolutely. And one thing that I should point out is that the app is 100% free. It's free to download it. And, you know, we are focusing right now on building our community. Over time, we will figure out or we will implement monetization strategies. But as it stands right now, we really want to build this community and make this an important part of people's long-term recovery. We really think that developing an app and creating a community, which is recovery first, which actually appeals to people in recovery as a group that we want to support, you know, just as there are communities out there for people who are, there are women's groups, there are groups for people who hike or fish or whatever it is that are purposely built for them and their needs. We want to do that because that doesn't really exist right now. There is no brand out there that aspirationally appeals to the recovery community. You know, there might be people that are out there trying to be of service to the recovery community in a kind of a paternalistic fashion. But no, we think that recovery is awesome and that we want more people to revel in that lifestyle.
All right. Now, we have some listener questions that have come in. And again, we want to thank everybody that takes the time to send these in. This one comes in via email and says, I am curious how this online app works to protect one's privacy and what safeguards you have in place to keep participants from being victimized by pretenders who would take advantage of naive users. For example, young women who may have drug or alcohol problems.
I'm glad that you asked that question because, you know, it was the first thing that I thought of when we were developing this, is that we need to make sure that not only we deal with people's anonymity, but also their safety. What I would say is, first of all, people should not check their common sense at the door when they're creating a profile and interacting with others on this app. So immediately we would say, if you are concerned about your anonymity, create a public profile that doesn't reveal too much information about yourself. And if you would like to have a secondary profile or a private profile where more personal information is revealed, please feel free to do that. And that will only be revealed to the people that you establish a buddy relationship with. On that point, though, if you want to make sure, a way that we are helping to weed out people who would be pretenders or just not great people in the community is we're asking people to vouch for the positive attributes of the people that they're friends with. So we have something called cosigns. And the cosigns allow you to say, this person has integrity, this person is trustworthy, this person is committed to their recovery, et cetera, et cetera. We have 36 different positive attributes that you can use to compliment somebody. And so if you see somebody that has a whole bunch of cosigns, then you'll know that hopefully that person is a good person. And you can also see who it is that has provided those cosigns, and you can click through to those people and maybe vet them a little bit as well. On the kind of negative side, what we're able to do is that if somebody is acting like a jerk, mm-hmm. you can block them, and then you can also report them. And we want to make sure that people feel as safe as possible on this. And we also want to, people will use it for what they'll use it for, but we don't want this to become a dating site.
It's not a 13th step.
It's not a 13th step thing. And 13th step, actually, I don't even like that term because it's serious. Mm-hmm. Recovery is supposed to be a place where people feel comfortable, where they support each other. And even in the rooms of the 12 steps, there people might laugh about this whole 13th step thing. But I find it really sad if people can't feel comfortable, they can't feel supported, they can't feel safe going and pursuing what's going to save their lives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm still trying to see if I can count 36 positive attributes of myself. Okay, well, another listener question that came in. It says, is the app based on more than locality, and is it also on type of condition?
Well, there are, I don't know the exact number of different attributes that we're asking for, but for example, we ask for people's sobriety date. We ask them for where their hometown is. We ask them about, where they attended treatment, if at all. We ask them what their interests are, and the list of interests is exhaustive. It's like 100 different boxes that you can check that are searchable. We ask them also what their kind of recovery affiliation is. So it lists a whole bunch of different 12-step options and, you know, these other groups that I had mentioned before, including Smart Recovery, Refuge Recovery, Life Ring. We have YPR affiliations. We have, you know, we're hoping, actually, we're going to be implementing, you know, people being able to check off. I went to, you know, Hazleton Betty Ford, for example, so that people can look for, similarities along a number of different lines. But yes, the thing that the primary filter for seeing other people in your locality is based on your GPS location.
As we're sitting here at TED, you know, we to get guests like you on is so great because of your knowledge just of the field. And I know you're a big BF service guy, and I know that you're involved in a lot of advocacy stuff. So for our listeners listening, talk to us a little bit about what's going on with the Comprehensive Addiction Act and the funding and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking about that. So CARA, which is the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016, We can see that as a victory because it's the biggest thing that's ever happened in the recovery advocacy movement. On July 12th, the Senate passed this act, and it was signed into law by the president. But and so this allocated $580 million for to dedicate towards the continuum of care for recovery. So that includes prevention, treatment, and recovery support. Unfortunately, well, two things happened. First is that that $580 million has not been funded yet. So without any emergency funding to address the lives we lose every day, we are losing 396 people every day on average to the disease of addiction, substance use disorder. And, you know, if you go to the Young People in Recovery website, that's youngpeopleinrecovery.org, you will see that it's kind of morbid. Well, it's very morbid, but there is a death clock that's on that on the site showing that since July 12th, 2016, which is the date that they could have actually started implementing these programs, I'm looking at it right now, there's 10,679 people that have died since then. And, you know, it's been approved. It needs to be funded. And the second thing is that, you know, what actually ended up being approved by the Senate and signed by the president, while it's great that this money is being allocated for that, it doesn't actually put in as much into recovery support as we hope that it would. So, for example, there are recovery high schools that we think should be funded so that people who are, you know, under 18 are able to get a real good, be in the midst of a community that's going to be super supportive of them, because we know that as a late teen and an early adult, there's a lot of drinking and using behavior that goes on. And if they don't have a chance to really connect to not only people, but also environments that are going to be supportive of their recovery, it's going to be difficult for them to maintain. I would also encourage people on that point to look at a film that just came out by a guy named Greg Williams.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys have heard about it already. It's called Generation Found. It's focused on a recovery high school, a trailblazing recovery high school down in Houston. And
it was a good movie. I was with you at that screening, actually.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that was a great movie. Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, those types of programs are not getting the funding that they could be getting if CARA had been passed in the way that we had hoped that it would be.
Well, I have two thoughts when we're talking about the funding. One is that what seems to be the holdup in it, and is there anything that we can ask people to do to push that through? In other words, is it being held up in a committee? Is it being held up in the Senate? And, you know, wherever it is, let us know so that we can help put some pressure out there. So that's the first question. So is there?
I think that people need to raise the, create more accountability with their representatives, because they basically were able to give themselves a pat on the back by passing this, but by without funding it, it does, it's kind of meaningless.
Exactly.
So I recommend people actually reach out to their representatives and ask them when that funding is going to be put into place. And it's just, it's really shocking, actually, when you compare the amount of funding that has been provided. $580 million is a drop in the bucket versus what really needs to be allocated. A couple of things. First, what has been allocated for recovery, quote unquote, has a lot of the evidence about a long-term recovery is based on what's been collected around medication-assisted treatment. And medication-assisted treatment is an important way to get people not to overdose, right? But long-term recovery, abstinence-based recovery, it's harder to collect evidence on that. So since that evidence doesn't exist, so specifically because a lot of people are, for example, in 12-step communities, which are based on anonymity, so you don't really collect information on those people. But since that evidence doesn't exist, it's harder to get money allocated mm-hmm. to it. So I'm hoping, and I think that the movement is hoping that we can get more money allocated to long-term recovery supports, getting people into sober living, mm-hmm. You know, these recovery high schools, et cetera. Because as you said at the beginning, you know, putting someone into treatment for 30 days helps to get them, you know, helps to clear their heads, but it doesn't help them to deal with how to stay sober for the rest of their lives. There needs to be, at least in my experience, mm-hmm. I needed to stay in sober living for 6 months. I needed to go to an intensive outpatient program. I needed to be taught a whole bunch of skills and tools, mindfulness and spirituality that will help me to continue to make the good decision to stay sober on a daily basis. And if you look at what has been funded, you know, the $580 million versus some other kind of public health emergencies that are taking place in this country, it's staggering. You look at
like Ebola, you're saying.
Ebola, yeah. The Ebola virus, I think that there have been 8 cases that have been documented in the United States, but they've gotten $1.8 billion in emergency funding. Mm-hmm. If you look at Zika, which of course is something that we should be making sure doesn't spread, but that's gotten over $1.5 billion in funding, and it only impacts, it has, you know, 86 cases in the state so far. And if you compare that to the number of people who die on an annual, just on a daily basis from substance use disorder, I already told you it's almost 400 people. So that there's some type of disconnect there. And since this is such a huge public health emergency in this country, I don't understand why it's not getting more attention. And, you know, part of what we all can do is to make sure that it is prioritized and that it is seen as a public health emergency that impacts good people who have an illness, as opposed to, you know, stigmatized, you know, people down in the, you know, in the ghetto who are just dying because of bad decisions.
Well, and I think that that leads to a whole nother issue, which, you know, you and I briefly talked about before the show, that it really depends on who these diseases and who these people, who it affects. And now that we've got this opiate epidemic that's affecting, quote, white America, and these aren't, quote, criminals or, you know, the lower social and economic class, now there seems to be a light being shed on it more than in the past.
Absolutely. I'm going to choose my words carefully.
Right. No, me too. I did too. I know. It's a touchy subject, but yeah.
Well, you know, I'm African American, and I do think that there was a lot of stigma. The criminalization of addiction that took place around, specifically around the crack epidemic, mm-hmm. You know, talking about people as if they were subhuman, mm-hmm. Defective people who were suffering from this disease, and having it, you know, at least what's portrayed in the media, be primarily people in the inner city, mm-hmm. didn't do addicts any favor, didn't do people who were suffering, excuse me, from substance use disorder any mm-hmm. favors. Because they were thought of as being less than and of being criminals, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, it is what it is, but the reason that it seems to be getting more attention and funding is because the captain of the football team, right, and, you know, the head cheerleader are suffering from this and dying. And, you know, it is you know, it, maybe that's what it took in order to get at least the attention that it deserved, but we still need action to be taken. Mm-hmm.
Ted, thank you so much. I mean, first of all, we would love to have you come back because this is great. And again, for everybody out there, go to the MOBR app or the Facebook page for MOBR, and you can learn more information. We are just about out of time. We just want to make sure for everybody out there to be sure to put on your calendar and tune in next Monday, August 15th, when our guest Jameson Monroe will discuss teenage self-destructive behavior and what drives it and how we can fix it.
And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com.
And you may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21 day to achieving the quality and thankfulness through self-discovery.
The next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word.
All right, Matt, Ted, thank you so much. For everybody else out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.